car and, as he turned to go, almost shouted in a rageful, passionate voice. An earthquake. A big one.
There was no earthquake, and the whole of the following day was spent, so far as Ryu was concerned, in long drives to every corner of the town, in parleyings with the families of the sick, and arguments with the invalids themselves.
Never had Ryu known his profession to weigh on him so heavily. Hitherto, his patients had helped to lighten his task. They gladly put themselves into his hands. For the first time, the doctor felt they were keeping aloof, wrapping themselves up in their malady with a sort of bemused hostility. It was a struggle to which he wasn't yet accustomed. And when, at 10 that evening, he parked his car outside the home of his old asthma patient, his last visitor of the day, it was an effort for Ryu to drag himself from his seat. For some moments he lingered, gazing up the dark street, watching the stars appear and disappear in the blackness of the sky. When Ryu entered the room, the old man was sitting up in bed, at his usual occupation, counting out dried peas from one pan to another. On seeing his visitor, he looked up, beaming with delight.
"Well, doctor, it's cholera, isn't it?"
"Where on earth did you get that idea from?"
"It's in the paper. And the radio said it, too."
"No, it's not cholera."
"Anyhow," the old man chuckled excitedly, "the big bugs are laying it on thick. Got the jitters, haven't they?"
"Don't you believe a word of it," the doctor said. He had examined the old man and now was sitting in the middle of the dingy little dining room. Yes, despite what he had said, he was afraid. He knew that in this suburb alone, 8 or 10 unhappy people, cowering over their buboes, would be awaiting his visit next morning. In only 2 or 3 cases had incision of the buboes caused any improvement. For most of them, it would mean going to the hospital, and he knew how poor people feel about hospitals.
"I don't want them trying their experiments on him," had said the wife of one of his patients.
But he wouldn't be experimented on. He would die. That was all. That the regulations now in force were inadequate was lamentably clear. As for the specially equipped wards, he knew what they amounted to. 2 outbuildings from which the other patients had been hastily evacuated, whose windows had been hermetically sealed, and round which a sanitary cordon had been set. The only hope was that the outbreak would die a natural death. It certainly wouldn't be arrested by the measures the authorities had so far devised. Nevertheless, that night the official communique was still optimistic. On the following day, Ronsdok announced that the rules laid down by the local administration had won general approval, and already 30 sick persons had reported. Castell rang up Ryu.
"How many beds are there in the special wards?"
80.
"Surely there are far more than 30 cases in the town."
"Don't forget there are 2 sorts of cases. Those who take fright, and those, they're the majority, who don't have time to do so."
"I see. Are they checking up on the burials?"
"No. I told Richard over the phone that energetic measures were needed, not just words. We'd got to set up a real barrier against the disease. Otherwise, we might just as well do nothing."
"Yes, and what did he say?"
"Nothing doing. He hadn't the powers. In my opinion, it's going to get worse." That was so. Within 3 days, both wards were full. According to Richard, there was talk of requisitioning a school and opening an auxiliary hospital. Meanwhile, Ryu continued incising buboes and waiting for the anti-plague serum. Castell went back to his old books and spent long hours in the public library. "Those rats died of plague," was his conclusion, "or of something extremely like it. And they've loosed on the town tens of thousands of fleas, which will spread the infection in geometrical progression unless it's checked in time.
Ryu said nothing.
About this time, the weather appeared set fair, and the sun had drawn up the last puddles left by the recent rain. There was a serene blue sky flooded with golden light each morning, with sometimes a drone of planes in the rising heat. All seemed well with the world. And yet within 4 days, the fever had made 4 startling strides. 16 deaths, 24, 28, and 32. On the 4th day, the opening of the auxiliary hospital in the premises of a primary school was officially announced. The local population, who so far had made a point of masking their anxiety by facetious comments, now seemed tongue-tied and went their ways with gloomy faces. Ryu decided to ring up the prefect. "The regulations don't go anywhere near far enough." "Yes," the prefect replied. "I've seen the statistics, and as you say, they're most perturbing."
"They're more than perturbing, they're conclusive."
"I'll ask government for orders." When Ryu next met Castell, the prefect's remark was still rankling.
"Orders," he said scornfully, "when what's needed is imagination."
"Any news of the serum?"
"It'll come this week."
The prefect sent instructions to Ryu, through Richard, asking him to draw up a minute to be transmitted for orders to the central administration of the colony. Ryu included in it a clinical diagnosis and statistics of the epidemic. On that day, 40 deaths were reported. The prefect took the responsibility, as he put it, of tightening up the new regulations. Compulsory declaration of all cases of fever and their isolation were to be strictly enforced. The residences of sick people were to be shut up and disinfected. Persons living in the same house were to go into quarantine. Burials were to be supervised by the local authorities, in a manner which will be described later on. Next day, the serum arrived by plane. There was enough for immediate requirements, but not enough if the epidemic were to spread. In reply to his telegram, Ryu was informed that the emergency reserve stock was exhausted, but that a new supply was in preparation. Meanwhile, from all the outlying districts, spring was making its progress into the town. Thousands of roses wilted in the flower vendors' baskets in the marketplaces and along the streets, and the air was heavy with their cloying perfume. Outwardly, indeed, this spring was like any other. The street cars were always packed at the rush hours, empty and untidy during the rest of the day. Taru watched the little man, and the little old man spat on the cats. Gron hurried home every evening to his mysterious literary activities. Kotar went his usual desultory ways, and Monsieur Auton, the magistrate, continued to parade his menagerie. The old Spaniard decanted his dried peas from pan to pan. And sometimes you encountered Rambert, the journalist, looking interested as ever in all he saw. In the evening, the usual crowd thronged the streets, and the lines lengthened outside the picture houses. Moreover, the epidemic seemed to be on the wane. On some days, only 10 or so deaths were notified. Then, all of a sudden, the figure shot up again, vertically. On the day when the death toll reached 30, Dr. Ryu read an official telegram that the prefect had just handed him, remarking, "So they've got alarmed at last." The telegram ran, "Proclaim a state of plague. Stop. Close the town." Part 2. From now on, it can be said that plague was the concern of all of us. Hitherto, surprised as he may have been by the strange things happening around him, each individual citizen had gone about his business as usual, so far as this was possible. And no doubt he would have continued doing so. But once the town gates were shut,
every one of us realized that all, the narrator included, were, so to speak, in the same boat. And each would have to adapt himself to the new conditions of life. Thus, for example, a feeling normally as individual as the ache of separation from those one loves suddenly became a feeling in which all shared alike and, together with fear, the greatest affliction of the long period of exile that lay ahead. One of the most striking consequences of the closing of the gates was, in fact, this sudden deprivation befalling people who were completely unprepared for it. Mothers and children, lovers, husbands and wives, who had a few days previously taken it for granted that their parting would be a short one, who had kissed one another goodbye on the platform and exchanged a few trivial remarks, sure as they were of seeing one another again after a few days, or at most, a few weeks, duped by our blind human faith in the near future, and little, if at all, diverted from their normal interest by this leave-taking. All these people found themselves, without the least warning, hopelessly cut off, prevented from seeing one another again, or even communicating with one another. For actually, the closing of the gates took place some hours before the official order was made known to the public, and naturally enough, it was impossible to take individual cases of hardship into account. It might indeed be said that the first effect of this brutal visitation was to compel our townspeople to act as if they had no feelings as individuals. During the first part of the day in which the prohibition to leave the town came into force, the prefect's office was besieged by a crowd of applicants advancing pleas of equal cogency, but equally impossible to take into consideration. Indeed, it needed several days for us to realize that we were completely cornered, that words like special arrangements, favor, and priority had lost all effective meaning. Even the small satisfaction of writing letters was denied us. It came to this. Not only had the town ceased to be in touch with the rest of the world by normal means of communication, but also, according to a second notification, all correspondence was forbidden to obviate the risk of letters carrying infection outside the town. In the early days, a favored few managed to persuade the sentries at the gates to allow them to get messages through to the outside world. But that was only at the beginning of the epidemic, when the sentries found it natural to obey their feelings of humanity. Later on, when these same sentries had had the gravity of the situation drummed into them, they flatly refused to take responsibilities whose possible after-effects they couldn't foresee. At first, telephone calls to other towns were allowed. But this led to such crowding of the telephone booths and delays on the lines that for some days they also were prohibited, and thereafter limited to what were called urgent cases, such as deaths, marriages, and births. So we had to fall back on telegrams. People linked together by friendship, affection, or physical love found themselves reduced to hunting for tokens of their past communion within the compass of a 10-word telegram. And since, in practice, the phrases one can use in a telegram are quickly exhausted, long lives passed side by side, or passionate yearnings, soon declined to the exchange of such trite formulas as, "Am well. Always thinking of you. Love." Some few of us, however, persisted in writing letters and gave much time to hatching plans for corresponding with the outside world. But almost always these plans came to nothing. Even on the rare occasions when they succeeded, we couldn't know this, since we received no answer. For weeks on end, we were reduced to starting the same letter over and over again, recopying the same scraps of news and the same personal appeals, with the result that after a certain time, the living words, into which we had, as it were, transfused our heart's blood, were drained of any meaning. Thereafter, we went on copying them mechanically, trying, through the dead phrases, to convey some notion of our ordeal.
And in the long run, to these sterile, reiterated monologues, these futile colloquies with a blank wall, even the banal formulas of a telegram came to seem preferable. Also, after some days, when it was clear that no one had the least hope of being able to leave our town, inquiries began to be made whether the return of people who had gone away before the outbreak would be permitted. After some days' consideration of the matter, the authorities replied affirmatively. They pointed out, however, that in no case would persons who returned be allowed to leave the town again. Once here, they would have to stay, whatever happened. Some families, actually very few, refused to take the position seriously, and in their eagerness to have the absent members of the family with them again, cast prudence to the winds and wired to them to take this opportunity of returning. But very soon those who were prisoners of the plague realized the terrible danger to which this would expose their relatives, and sadly resigned themselves to their absence. At the height of the epidemic, we saw only one case in which natural emotions overcame the fear of death in a particularly painful form. It wasn't, as might be expected, the case of two young people, whose passion made them yearn for each other's nearness at whatever cost of pain. The two were old Dr. Castell and his wife, and they had been married for very many years. Madame Castell had gone on a visit to a neighboring town some days before the epidemic started. They weren't one of those exemplary married couples of the Darby and Joan pattern. On the contrary, the narrator has grounds for saying that, in all probability, neither partner felt quite sure the marriage was all that could have been desired. But this ruthless, protracted separation enabled them to realize that they couldn't live apart. And in the sudden glow of this discovery, the risk of plague seemed insignificant. That was an exception. For most people, it was obvious that the separation must last until the end of the epidemic. And for every one of us, the ruling emotion of his life, which he had imagined he knew through and through. The people of Auron, as has been said, have simple passions. Took on a new aspect. Husbands, who had had complete faith in their wives, found, to their surprise, that they were jealous. And lovers had the same experience. Men who had pictured themselves as Don Juans became models of fidelity. Sons who had lived beside their mothers, hardly giving them a glance, fell to picturing with poignant regret each wrinkle in the absent face that memory cast upon the screen. This drastic, clean-cut deprivation, and our complete ignorance of what the future held in store, had taken us unawares. We were unable to react against the mute appeal of presences, still so near and already so far, which haunted us day long. In fact, our suffering was twofold, our own to start with, and then the imagined suffering of the absent one, son, mother, wife, or mistress. Under other circumstances, our townsfolk would probably have found an outlet in increased activity or more sociable life. But the plague forced inactivity on them, limiting their movements to the same dull round inside the town and throwing them day after day on the elusive solace of their memories. For in their aimless walks they kept on coming back to the same streets, and usually, owing to the smallness of the town, these were streets in which, in happier days, they had walked with those who now were absent. Thus the first thing that plague brought to our town was exile. And the narrator is convinced that he can set down here as holding good for all the feeling he personally had, and to which many of his friends confessed. It was undoubtedly the feeling of exile, that sensation of a void within which never left us, that irrational longing to hark back to the past or else to speed up the march of time, and those keen shafts of memory that stung like fire. Sometimes we toyed with our imagination, composing ourselves to wait for a ring at the bell announcing somebody's return, or for the sound of a familiar footstep on the stairs, But though we might deliberately stay at home at the hour when a traveler coming by the evening train would normally have arrived, and though we might contrive to forget for the moment that no trains were running, that game of make-believe, for obvious reasons, couldn't last. Always a moment came when we had to face the fact that no trains were coming in. And then we realized that the separation was destined to continue. We had no choice but to come to terms with the days ahead. In short, we returned to our prison house. We had nothing left us but the past, and even if some were tempted to live in the future, they had speedily to abandon the idea. Anyhow, as soon as could be. Once they felt the wounds that the imagination inflicts on those who yield themselves to it. It's noteworthy that our townspeople very quickly desisted, even in public, from a habit one might have expected them to form, that of trying to figure out the probable duration of their exile. The reason was this. When the most pessimistic had fixed it at, say, 6 months, when they had drunk in advance the dregs of bitterness of those 6 black months, and painfully screwed up their courage to the sticking place, straining all the remaining energy to endure valiantly the long ordeal of all those weeks and days, when they had done this, some friend they met, an article in a newspaper, a vague suspicion, or a flash of foresight would suggest that, after all, there was no reason why the epidemic shouldn't last more than 6 months. Why not a year? Or even more? At such moments, the collapse of their courage, willpower, and endurance was so abrupt that they felt they could never drag themselves out of the pit of despond into which they had fallen. Therefore, they forced themselves never to think about the problematic day of escape, to cease looking to the future, and always to keep, so to speak, their eyes fixed on the ground at their feet. But naturally enough, this prudence, this habit of fainting with their predicament and refusing to put up a fight, was ill-rewarded. For while averting that revulsion which they found so unbearable, they also deprived themselves of those redeeming moments, frequent enough when all is told, when by conjuring up pictures of a reunion to be, they could forget about the plague. Thus, in a middle course between these heights and depths, they drifted through life rather than lived, the prey of aimless days and sterile memories, like wandering shadows that could have acquired substance only by consenting to root themselves in the solid earth of their distress. Thus, too, they came to know the incorrigible sorrow of all prisoners and exiles, which is to live in company with a memory that serves no purpose. Even the past, of which they thought incessantly, had a savor only of regret, for they would have wished to add to it all that they regretted having left undone, while they might yet have done it, with the man or woman whose return they now awaited. Just as in all the activities, even the relatively happy ones, of their life as prisoners, they kept vainly trying to include the absent one. And thus there was always something missing in their lives. Hostile to the past, impatient of the present, and cheated of the future, we were much like those whom men's justice, or hatred, forces to live behind prison bars. Thus the only way of escaping from that intolerable leisure was to set the trains running again in one's imagination and in filling the silence with the fancied tinkle of a doorbell, in practice obstinately mute. Still, if it was an exile, it was, for most of us, exile in one's own home. And though the narrator experienced only the common form of exile, he cannot forget the case of those who, like Rambert, the journalist, and a good many others, had to endure an aggravated deprivation, since being travelers caught by the plague and forced to stay where they were cut off both from the person with whom they wanted to be and from their homes as well. In the general exile, they were the most exiled. since while time gave rise for them, as for us all, to the suffering appropriate to it, there was also for them the space factor. They were obsessed by it, and at every moment knocked their heads against the walls of this huge and alien Lazar house, secluding them from their lost homes. These were the people, no doubt, whom one often saw wandering forlornly in the dusty town at all hours of the day, silently invoking nightfalls known to them alone and the day springs of their happier land. And they fed their despondency with fleeting intimations, messages as disconcerting as a flight of swallows, a dewfall at sundown, or those queer glints the sun sometimes dapples on empty streets. As for that outside world, which can always offer an escape from everything, they shut their eyes to it, bent as they were on cherishing the all-too-real phantoms of their imagination, and conjuring up with all their might pictures of a land where a special play of light, two or three hills, a favorite tree, a woman's smile, composed for them a world that nothing could replace. To come at last, and more specifically, to the case of parted lovers, who present the greatest interest, and of whom the narrator is, perhaps, better qualified to speak, their minds were the prey of different emotions, notably remorse. For their present position enabled them to take stock of their feelings with a sort of feverish objectivity. And in these conditions, it was rare for them not to detect their own shortcomings. What first brought these home to them was the trouble they experienced in summoning up any clear picture of what the absent one was doing. They came to deplore their ignorance of the way in which that person used to spend his or her days, and reproached themselves for having troubled too little about this in the past, and for having affected to think that, for a lover, the occupations of the loved one when they are not together could be a matter of indifference and not a source of joy. Once this had been brought home to them, they could retrace the course of their love and see where it had fallen short. In normal times, all of us know, whether consciously or not, that there's no love which can't be bettered. Nevertheless, we reconcile ourselves more or less easily to the fact that ours has never risen above the average. But memory is less disposed to compromise. And in a very definite way, this misfortune which had come from outside and befallen a whole town did more than inflict on us an unmerited distress with which we might well be indignant. It also incited us to create our own suffering and thus to accept frustration as a natural state. This was one of the tricks the pestilence had of diverting attention and confounding issues. Thus each of us had to be content to live only for the day, alone under the vast indifference of the sky. This sense of being abandoned, which might in time have given characters a finer temper, began, however, by sapping them to the point of futility. For instance, some of our fellow citizens became subject to a curious kind of servitude, which put them at the mercy of the sun and the rain. Looking at them, you had an impression that for the first time in their lives they were becoming, as some would say, weather-conscious. A burst of sunshine was enough to make them seem delighted with the world, while rainy days gave a dark cast to their faces and their mood. A few weeks before, they had been free of this absurd subservience to the weather, because they had not to face life alone. The person they were living with held, to some extent, the foreground of their little world. But from now on it was different. They seemed at the mercy of the sky's caprices. In other words, suffered and hoped irrationally. Moreover, in this extremity of solitude, none could count on any help from his neighbor. Each had to bear the load of his troubles alone. If, by some chance, one of us tried to unburden himself or to say something about his feelings, the reply he got, whatever it might be, usually wounded him. And then it dawned on him that he and the man with him weren't talking about the same thing. For while he himself spoke from the depths of long days of brooding upon his personal distress, and the image he had tried to impart had been slowly shaped and proved in the fires of passion and regret. This meant nothing to the man to whom he was speaking, who pictured a conventional emotion, a grief that is traded on the marketplace, mass-produced. Whether friendly or hostile, the reply always missed fire, and the attempt to communicate had to be given up. This was true of those, at least, for whom silence was unbearable. And since the others couldn't find the truly expressive word, they resigned themselves to using the current coin of language, the commonplaces of plain narrative, of anecdote, and of their daily paper. So in these cases, too, even the sincerest grief had to make do with the set phrases of ordinary conversation. Only on these terms could the prisoners of the plague ensure the sympathy of their concierge and the interest of their hearers. Nevertheless, and this point is most important, however bitter their distress and however heavy their hearts, for all their emptiness, it can be truly said of these exiles that in the early period of the plague they could account themselves privileged. For at the precise moment when the residents of the town began to panic, their thoughts were wholly fixed on the person whom they longed to meet again. The egoism of love made them immune to the general distress, and if they thought of the plague, it was only insofar as it might threaten to make their separation eternal. Thus, in the very heart of the epidemic, they maintained a saving indifference, which one was tempted to take for composure. Their despair saved them from panic. Thus, their misfortune had a good side. For instance, if it happened that one of them was carried off by the disease, it was almost always without his having had time to realize it. Snatched suddenly from his long, silent communion with a wraith of memory, he was plunged straightway into the densest silence of all. He'd had no time for anything.
While our townspeople were trying to come to terms with their sudden isolation, the plague was posting sentries at the gates and turning away ships bound for Oran. No vehicle had entered the town since the gates were closed. From that day onwards, one had the impression that all cars were moving in circles. The harbor, too, presented a strange appearance to those who looked down on it from the top of the boulevards. The commercial activity that hitherto made it one of the chief ports on the coast had ceased abruptly. Only a few ships, detained in quarantine, were anchored in the bay. But the gaunt, idle cranes on the wharves, tip carts lying on their sides, neglected heaps of sacks and barrels, all testified that commerce, too, had died of plague. In spite of such unusual sights, our townsfolk apparently found it hard to grasp what was happening to them. There were feelings all could share, such as fear and separation, but personal interests, too, continued to occupy the foreground of their thoughts. Nobody as yet had really acknowledged to himself what the disease connoted. Most people were chiefly aware of what ruffled the normal tenor of their lives or affected their interests. They were worried and irritated. But these aren't feelings with which to confront plague. Their first reaction, for instance, was to abuse the authorities. The prefects were posed to criticisms echoed by the press. Couldn't the regulations be modified and made less stringent? Was somewhat unexpected. Hitherto, neither the newspapers nor the Rondstock Information Bureau had been given any official statistics relating to the epidemic. Now the prefect supplied them daily to the bureau with the request that they should be broadcast once a week. In this, too, the reaction of the public was slower than might have been expected. Thus the bare statement that 302 deaths had taken place in the third week of plague failed to strike their imagination. For one thing, all the 302 deaths might not have been due to plague. Also, no one in the town had any idea of the average weekly death rate in ordinary times. The population of the town was about 200,000. There was no knowing if the present death rate were really so abnormal. This is, in fact, the kind of statistics that nobody ever troubles much about, notwithstanding that its interest is obvious. The public lacked, in short, standards of comparison. It was only as time passed, and the steady rise in the death rate couldn't be ignored, that public opinion became alive to the truth. For in the fifth week, there were 321 deaths, and 345 in the sixth. These figures, anyhow, spoke for themselves. Yet they were still not sensational enough to prevent our townsfolk, perturbed though they were, from persisting in the idea that what was happening was a sort of accident, disagreeable enough, but certainly of a temporary order. So they went on strolling about the town as usual and sitting at the tables on cafe terraces. Generally speaking, they didn't lack courage, bandied more jokes than lamentations, and made a show of accepting cheerfully unpleasantnesses that obviously could be only passing. In short, they kept up appearances. However, toward the end of the month, about the time of the week of prayer, which will be described later on, there were more serious developments, altering the whole aspect of the town. To begin with, the prefect took measures controlling the traffic and the food supply. Gas was rationed and restrictions were placed on the sale of foodstuffs. Reductions were ordered in the use of electricity. Only necessaries were brought by road or air to Oran. Thus the traffic thinned out progressively until hardly any private cars were on the roads. Luxury shops closed overnight, and others began to put up sold-out notices, while crowds of buyers stood waiting at their doors. Oran assumed a novel appearance. You saw more pedestrians, and in the slack hours, numbers of people, reduced to idleness because shops and a good many offices were closed, crowded the streets and cafes. For the present, they weren't unemployed, merely on holiday. So it was that on fine days, toward 3 in the afternoon, Oran brought to mind a city where public rejoicings are in progress. Shops are shut, and traffic is stopped to give a merry-making populace the freedom of the streets. Naturally, the picture houses benefited by the situation and made money hand over fist. They had one difficulty, however, to provide a change of program, since the circulation of films in the region had been suspended. After a fortnight, the various cinemas were obliged to exchange films, and after a further lapse of time, to show always the same program. In spite of this, their takings didn't fall off. The cafes, thanks to the big stocks accumulated in a town where the wine and liquor trade holds pride of place, were equally able to cater to their patrons. And to tell the truth, there was much heavy drinking. One of the cafes had the brilliant idea of putting up a slogan, "The best protection against infection is a bottle of good wine," which confirmed an already prevalent opinion that alcohol is a safeguard against infectious disease. Every night, toward 2 a.m., quite a number of drunken men, ejected from the cafes, staggered down the streets, vociferating optimism. Yet all these changes were, in one sense, so fantastic, and had been made so precipitately, that it wasn't easy to regard them as likely to have any permanence, with the result that we went on focusing our attention on our personal feelings. When leaving the hospital 2 days after the gates were closed, Dr. Ryu met Kotar in the street. The little man was beaming with satisfaction. Ryu congratulated him on his appearance. "Yes," Kotar said, "I'm feeling very fit. Never was fitter in my life. But tell me, doctor, this blasted plague, what about it?" "Getting to look mighty serious, isn't it?" When the doctor nodded, he continued exuberantly. "And there's no reason for it to stop now. This town's going to be in an unholy mess by the look of things." They walked a little way together. Kotar told the story of a grocer in the street who had laid by masses of canned provisions with the idea of selling them later on at a big profit. When the ambulance men came to fetch him, he had several dozen cans of meat under his bed. "He died in the hospital. There's no money in plague, that's sure." Kotar was a mine of stories of the made by masses of canned provisions with the idea of selling them later on at a big profit.
When the ambulance men came to fetch him, he had several dozen cans of meat under his bed.
He died in the hospital. There's no money in plague, that's sure.
Kotar was a mine of stories of this kind, true or false, about the epidemic. One of them was about a man with all the symptoms and running a high fever who dashed out into the street, flung himself on the first woman he met, and embraced her, yelling that he'd got it. Good for him, was Kotar's comment. But his next remark seemed to belie his gleeful exclamation.
Anyhow, we'll all be nuts before long, unless I'm much mistaken.
It was on the afternoon of the same day that Grant at last unburdened himself to Rieu. Noticing Madame Rieu's photograph on the desk, he looked at the doctor inquiringly. Rieu told him that his wife was under treatment in a sanatorium some distance from the town. In one way, Grant said, that's lucky. The doctor agreed that it was lucky in a sense. But he added, the great thing was that his wife should recover. Yes, Grant said. I understand. And then, for the first time since Rieu had made his acquaintance, he became quite voluble. Though he still had trouble over his words, he succeeded nearly always in finding them. Indeed, it was as if for years he'd been thinking over what he now said. When in his teens, he had married a very young girl, one of a poor family living nearby. It was, in fact, in order to marry that he'd abandoned his studies and taken up his present job. Neither he nor Jean ever stirred from their part of the town. In his courting days, he used to go to see her at her home, and the family were inclined to make fun of her bashful, silent admirer. Her father was a railroad man. When off duty, he spent most of the time seated in a corner beside the window, gazing meditatively at the passers-by, his enormous hands splayed out on his thighs. His wife was always busy with domestic duties, in which Jean gave her a hand. Jean was so tiny that it always made Grand nervous to see her crossing a street. The vehicles bearing down on her looked so gigantic. Then one day, shortly before Christmas, they went out for a short walk together and stopped to admire a gaily decorated shop window. After gazing ecstatically at it for some moments, Jean turned to him. Oh, isn't it lovely? He squeezed her wrist. It was thus that the marriage had come about. The rest of the story, to Grand's thinking, was very simple. The common lot of married couples. You get married, you go on loving a bit longer, you work. And you work so hard that it makes you forget to love. As the head of the office where Grant was employed hadn't kept his promise, Jean, too, had to work outside. At this point, a little imagination was needed to grasp what Grant was trying to convey. Owing largely to fatigue, he gradually lost his grip of himself, had less and less to say, and failed to keep alive the feeling in his wife that she was loved. An overworked husband, poverty, the gradual loss of hope in a better future, silent evenings at home. What chance had any passion of surviving such conditions? Probably Jean had suffered, and yet she'd stayed. Of course, one may often suffer a long time without knowing it. Thus years went by. Then, one day, she left him. Naturally, she hadn't gone alone. I was very fond of you. But now I'm so tired. I'm not happy to go, but one needn't be happy to make another start. That, more or less, was what she'd said in her letter. Grand, too, had suffered. And he, too, might, as Rieu pointed out, have made a fresh start. But no, he had lost faith. Only he couldn't stop thinking about her. What he'd have liked to do was to write her a letter justifying himself. But it's not easy, he told Rieu. I've been thinking it over for years. While we loved each other, we didn't need words to make ourselves understood. But people don't love forever. A time came when I should have found the words to keep her with me. Only I couldn't.
Gron produced from his pocket something that looked like a check duster and blew his nose noisily. Then he wiped his mustache. Ryu gazed at him in silence. "Forgive me, Doctor," Gron added hastily. "But how shall I put it? I feel you're to be trusted. That's why I can talk to you about these things. And then, you see, I get all worked up." Obviously, Gron's thoughts were leagues away from the plague. That evening, Ryu sent a telegram to his wife telling her that the town was closed, that she must go on taking great care of herself, and that she was in his thoughts. One evening, when he was leaving the hospital, it was about 3 weeks after the closing of the gates, Ryu found a young man waiting for him in the street. "You remember me, don't you?" Ryu believed he did, but couldn't quite place him. "I called on you just before this trouble started," the young man said, "for information about the living conditions in the Arab Quarter. My name is Raymond Rambert." "Ah, yes, of course. Well, you've now the makings of a good story for your paper." Rambert, who gave the impression of being much less self-assured than he had seemed on the first occasion when they met, said it wasn't that he'd come about. He wanted to know if the doctor would kindly give him some help. "I must apologize," he continued. "But really, I don't know a soul here, and the local representative of my paper is a complete dud." Ryu said he had to go to a dispensary in the center of the town, and suggested they should walk there together. Their way lay through the narrow streets of the Negro district. Evening was coming on, but the town, once so noisy at this hour, was strangely still. The only sounds were some bugle calls echoing through the air, still golden with the end of daylight. The army, anyhow, was making a show of carrying on as usual. Meanwhile, as they walked down the steep little streets flanked by blue, mauve, and saffron-yellow walls, Rambert talked incessantly, as if his nerves were out of hand. He had left his wife in Paris, he said. Well, she wasn't actually his wife, but it came to the same thing. The moment the town was put into quarantine, he had sent her a wire. His impression then was that the state of things was quite temporary, and all he tried to do was to get a letter through to her. But the post office officials had vetoed this. His colleagues of the local press said they could do nothing for him, and a clerk in the prefect's office had laughed in his face. It was only after waiting in line for a couple of hours that he had managed to get a telegram accepted. "All goes well. Hope to see you soon." But next morning, when he woke up, it had dawned on him that, after all, there was absolutely no knowing how long this business was going to last. So he decided to leave the town at once. Being able, thanks to his professional status, to pull some strings, he had secured an interview with a high official in the prefect's office. He had explained that his presence in Oran was purely accidental. He had no connection with the town, and no reasons for staying in it. That being so, he surely was entitled to leave, even if, once outside the town, he had to undergo a spell of quarantine. The official told him he quite appreciated his position, but no exceptions could be made. He would, however, see if anything could be done, though he could hold out little hope of a quick decision, as the authorities were taking a very serious view of the situation. "But confound it," Rambert exclaimed. "I don't belong here." "Quite so. Anyhow, let's hope the epidemic will soon be over." Finally, he had tried to console Rambert by pointing out that, as a journalist, he had an excellent subject to his hand in Oran. Indeed, when one came to think of it, no event, however disagreeable in some ways, but had its bright side. Whereat, Rambert had shrugged his shoulders petulantly and walked out. They had come to the center of the town. "It's so damn silly, Doctor, isn't it? The truth is, I wasn't brought into the world to write newspaper articles. But it's quite likely I was brought into the world to live with a woman. That's reasonable enough, isn't it?" Ryu replied cautiously that there might be something in what he said. The central boulevards were not so crowded as usual. The few people about were hurrying to distant homes. Not a smile was to be seen on any face. Ryu guessed that this was a result of the latest Rondstock announcement. After 24 hours, our townspeople would begin to hope again. But on the days when they were announced, the statistics were too fresh in everybody's memory. "The truth," Rambert remarked abruptly, "is that she and I have been together only a short time, and we suit each other perfectly." When Ryu said nothing, he continued, "I can see I'm boring you. Sorry. All I wanted to know was whether you couldn't possibly give me a certificate stating that I haven't got this damn disease. It might make things easier, I think." Ryu nodded. A small boy had just run against his legs and fallen. He set him on his feet again. Walking on, they came to the Place d'Armes. Gray with dust, the palms and fig trees drooped despondently around a statue of the Republic, which too was coated with grime and dust. They stopped beside the statue. Ryu stamped his feet on the flagstones to shake off the coat of white dust that had gathered on them. His hat pushed slightly back, his shirt collar gaping under a loosely knotted tie, his cheeks ill-shaven, the journalist had the sulky, stubborn look of a young man who feels himself deeply injured. "Please don't doubt I understand you," Ryu said. "But you must see your argument doesn't hold water. I can't give you that certificate because I don't know whether you have the disease or not. And even if I did, how could I certify that between the moment of leaving my consulting room and your arrival at the prefect's office, you wouldn't be infected? Even if I gave you a certificate, it wouldn't help." "Why not?" "Because there are thousands of people placed as you are in this town, and there can't be any question of allowing them to leave it. Even supposing they haven't got plague? That's not a sufficient reason." "Oh, I know it's an absurd situation, but we're all involved in it, and we've got to accept it as it is. But I don't belong here." "Unfortunately, from now on you'll belong here like everybody else." Rambert raised his voice a little. "But damn it, Doctor, can't you see it's a matter of common human feeling? Or don't you realize what this sort of separation means to people who are fond of each other?" Ryu was silent for a moment, then said he understood it perfectly. He wished nothing better than that Rambert should be allowed to return to his wife, and that all who loved one another and were parted should come together again. Only the law was the law, plague had broken out, and he could only do what had to be done. "No," Rambert said bitterly, "you can't understand. You're using the language of reason, not of the heart. You live in a world of abstractions." The doctor glanced up at the statue of the Republic, then said he didn't know if he was using the language of reason, but he knew he was using the language of the facts as everybody could see them, which wasn't necessarily the same thing. The journalist tugged at his tie to straighten it. "So, I take it, I can't count on help from you." "Very good, but..." His tone was challenging. "Leave this town, I shall." The doctor repeated that he quite understood, but all that was none of his business. "Excuse me, but it is your business." Rambert raised his voice again. "I approached you because I'd been told you played a large part in drawing up the orders that had been issued. So I thought that in one case, anyhow, you could unmake what you'd helped to make. But you don't care. You never gave a thought to anybody. You didn't take the case of people who are separated into account." Ryu admitted this was true up to a point. He'd preferred not to take such cases into account.
"Ah, I see now," Rambert exclaimed.
"You'll soon be talking about the interests of the general public. But public welfare is merely the sum total of the private welfares of each of us." The doctor seemed abruptly to come out of a dream. "Oh, come," he said. "There's that, but there's much more to it than that. It doesn't do to rush to conclusions, you know. But you've no reason to feel angered. I assure you that if you find a way out of your quandary, I shall be extremely pleased. Only there are things that my official position bars me from doing." Rambert tossed his head petulantly. "Yes, yes, I was wrong to show annoyance. And I've taken up too much of your time already." Ryu asked him to let him know how he got on with this project,
and not to bear him a grudge for not having been more amenable. He was sure, he added, that there was some common ground on which they could meet.
Rambert looked perplexed.
Then, yes, he said after a short silence, I rather think so, too, in spite of myself and of all you've just been saying. He paused. Still, I can't agree with you.
Pulling down his hat over his eyes, he walked quickly away. Ryu saw him enter the hotel where Taru was staying. After a moment, the doctor gave a slight nod, as if approving of some thought that had crossed his mind.
Yes.
The journalist was right in refusing to be balked of happiness. But was he right in reproaching him, Ryu, with living in a world of abstractions? Could that term, abstraction, really apply to these days he spent in his hospital where the plague was battening on the town, raising its death toll to 500 victims a week?
Yes, an element of abstraction, of a divorce from reality, entered into such calamities.
Still, when abstraction sets to killing you, you've got to get busy with it.
And so much Ryu knew that this wasn't the easiest course. Running this auxiliary hospital, for instance, of which he was in charge, there were now three such hospitals, was no light task.
He had had an anteroom leading into his surgery, installed, equipped for dealing with patients on arrival. The floor had been excavated and replaced by a shallow lake of water and chrysilic acid, in the center of which was a sort of island made of bricks. The patient was carried to the island, rapidly undressed, and his clothes dropped into the disinfectant water. After being washed, dried, and dressed in one of the coarse hospital nightshirts, he was taken to Ryu for examination, then carried to one of the wards. This hospital, a requisitioned schoolhouse, now contained 500 beds, almost all of which were occupied. After the reception of the patients, which he personally supervised, Ryu injected serum, lanced buboes, checked the statistics again, and returned for his afternoon consultations. Only when night was setting in did he start on his round of visits, and he never got home till a very late hour. On the previous night, his mother, when handing him a telegram from his wife, had remarked that his hands were shaking.
Yes, he said, but it's only a matter of sticking to it, and my nerves will steady down, you'll see.
He had a robust constitution, and as yet wasn't really tired. Still, his visits, for one thing, were beginning to put a great strain on his endurance. Once the epidemic was diagnosed, the patient had to be evacuated forthwith. Then, indeed, began abstraction and a tussle with the family, who knew they wouldn't see the sick man again until he was dead or cured.
"Have some pity, doctor."
It was Madame Loret, mother of the chambermaid at Taru's hotel, who made the appeal. An unnecessary appeal. Of course he had pity. But what purpose could it serve? He had to telephone, and soon the ambulance could be heard clanging down the street. At first, the neighbors used to open windows and watch. Later, they promptly shut them. Then came a second phase of conflict, tears, and pleadings. Abstraction, in a word. In those fever-hot, nerve-ridden sick rooms, crazy scenes took place. But the issue was always the same. The patient was removed. Then Ryu, too, could leave. In the early days, he had merely telephoned, then rushed off to see other patients, without waiting for the ambulance. But no sooner was he gone than the family locked and barred their doors, preferring contact with the plague to a parting whose issue they now knew only too well. There followed objurgations, screams, batterings on the door, action by the police, and later armed force. The patient was taken by storm. Thus, during the first few weeks, Ryu was compelled to stay with the patient till the ambulance came. Later, when each doctor was accompanied by a volunteer police officer, Ryu could hurry away to the next patient. But to begin with, every evening was like that evening when he was called in for Madame Loret's daughter.
He was shown into a small apartment decorated with fans and artificial flowers. The mother greeted him with a faltering smile.
"Oh, I do hope it's not the fever everyone's talking about."
Lifting the coverlet and chemise, he gazed in silence at the red blotches on the girl's thighs and stomach, the swollen